Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Back on the podcast is one of the few people out there who's ringing the bell of common sense and warning us that we are on a path to disaster if some reason doesn't actually reign in all of this thing with the coronavirus. Congressman Thomas Massey, Kentucky's 4th District. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Leland. Great to be back on the show with you.
I'm starting to get really concerned because, first of all, I feel like the whole country has gone into sort of this up and joined a cult, because it's like we're telling on each other if we don't deem whatever each other are doing is necessary outside of our homes. Anybody who brings up trying to reopen businesses is immediately accused by the masses of wanting people to die. Congressmen such as yourself are ridiculed in the media for talking about things like hope and reopening business. I feel almost like America's failing the character test here.
And now we've got a snitch line here in Kentucky. The governor set up a snitch line where you could call it and turn in your neighbor if you don't think that what they're doing complies with the governor's edicts.
Yeah.
And everybody's that's an executive, from mayors up to governors, are basically miniature tyrants now.
Yeah, it seems as though...
And people are okay with it.
Yeah.
And people are okay with it.
I posted yesterday on Twitter, I said, I feel like 75% of Kentucky is up and joined a cult, the cult of Andy Dad Jeans. And I was just kind of poking fun at Governor Beshear for his weird, sort of strange, laid-back, I don't know how to describe it, almost creepy briefings every day that the media just slobbers over. What's your take on the action he took against churches on Easter? He claims that he wasn't targeting churches, but he clearly was. I mean, he announced that before Easter, and then the overstep of sending state police to take down license plates, run those numbers, and then send unelected bureaucrats to people's houses to force them into a quarantine for 2 weeks when they weren't even suspected of having this virus.
And meanwhile, he's let out 600 felons. The same weekend he's going to track down all the Christians who are going to church, he lets out 600 felons out of jail. And I'm pretty sure they didn't get 600 COVID tests. I'm pretty sure he just assumed none of them have COVID and he let them out of jail.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Louisville Metro Police Department has announced they're not going to respond to burglaries or to hit and runs.
Right.
So it's like everything's upside down now.
I want to read some statistics I just got here from the Pegasus Institute. We've taken these actions up to this point ostensibly to avoid the overrun of our hospitals. And we've done that. We've achieved that. There are 3,636 beds available in the city of Louisville specifically. For COVID-19 patients all across U of L Health, Baptist, and Norton hospitals. Current total of COVID-19 hospitalizations, 156. 34 at U of L Health, 65 at Norton, 53 at Baptist. We have 3,636 beds available. We're using 156 of them. Why are we locked down?
You know, we're already having deaths from the actions that they've taken here in Kentucky to empty out all the rural hospitals. And hospitals in general, there are already people who are dying of heart attacks because they're at home and they're being told to stay at home and don't come to the doctor. There are already people committing suicide. You're going to see more and more of this. And how many cancer screenings aren't happening right now? You know,
right.
We've been told that it's important to catch all these issues quickly, whether it's diabetes or whether it's cancer or some other condition, yet right now nobody can get seen at a doctor,
right,
unless it's an emergency.
Right, right.
And by the way, they're laying off healthcare workers.
Yeah.
And these are the ones, the hospitals are going broke, the healthcare workers are being laid off, And the Democrats want to send more money to the hospitals. But here's the thing. You can send money to farmers. You can send money to hospitals. You can send money to manufacturing businesses. But that doesn't mean that people are getting health care. It doesn't mean that farmers are growing food. It doesn't mean that things are getting manufactured. It just means you're basically putting America on a ventilator.
Right. That's a good analogy. The hotline for Indiana's suicide help hotline or suicide prevention hotline normally got 1,000 calls a week. A Kentucky state legislator told me last week that they got 25,000 calls. Now, those are not all suicides, obviously, and hopefully they were able to prevent the vast majority of those. But that number of calls to the suicide help hotline alone was more than the number of deaths from coronavirus in the United States. And I think if we don't start to realize that there are real life, life and death consequences to an economic collapse, and that an economic collapse, which is what we're headed to if we stay locked down much longer, will absolutely kill magnitudes more than this virus ever even dreamed of.
I think we're already there. I would guess that the death rate is already higher.
Yeah.
From the government activity.
For somebody who says, how? Where are these deaths coming from? You have increased domestic violence. You have increased suicide with the loss of financial means. You have elderly who have lost their entire retirement. Those deaths will come later when they can no longer afford long-term care or the care that they were able to get. I mean, some of these are what you would call maybe third and second tier non-direct deaths, but they're still associated with the actions. There's still consequences of the actions we're taking right now.
Absolutely. And it's harder for people to get the medication. Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to talk about how the problem we faced in rural America of trying to get people to see a doctor or to go to a hospital. They would put these things off because it's such a trip to go, or, you know, a long trip to go find these services. But now it's virtually at a standstill.
Right.
And I have a pharmacist friend who says that they're getting conflicting information about between the states and the feds and the DEA about whether and under what circumstances you can refill a prescription if the person hasn't seen a doctor and the pharmacist can't get a hold of the doctors because they're not going to work. It's a nightmare.
One of the things I really wanted to talk to you about was what I think could be a coming meat shortage and even vegetable shortage as well. You've been posting some warning stories about this, and you have a piece of legislation that would literally head this off, at least in the meat side of things, but probably also for the vegetable side of things. What are you concerned about and why?
Well, let me tell you what I'm concerned about. You've probably, your listeners also have probably already seen the images, the videos of dairies pouring out thousands of gallons of milk. And meanwhile, the price of milk isn't going down in the store. And they depending on where you shop, they may be telling you can only get 2 gallons at a time or something. Mm-hmm. So the question is, why is all this milk being poured out? It's because, you know, half of the dairy supply was geared to a different pipeline. It was geared to selling cheese in totes to restaurants, mm-hmm. for instance, not mm-hmm. in 8-ounce packages labeled for individual sale. So it's hard for people to understand why the milk gets poured out, but once they understand about the supply lines, then they see why. Well, here's what I fear is coming, and this is already happening in the poultry industry. But so let me talk about the poultry industry first. They're already destroying hatchling eggs that would have been grown into meat chickens. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a big supply of frozen poultry, beef, and pork in the United States. And to some degree, that frozen supply grew when the restaurants weren't taking orders, weren't taking the meat. But what I'm seeing now is going into that pipeline of frozen food is a reduction of beef and pork and chicken that's getting processed.
Right.
And what I'm worried about, Leland, is if policy doesn't change, and I'm saying we're maybe 6 or 8 weeks away from this, not 6 months away from this.
Right.
You're going to watch farmers euthanize animals and destroy them on right. the farm
right.
and bury them or incinerate them or whatever, compost them. Meanwhile, you're going to have shortages in the store. This is what I'm concerned about in the absence of a change in policy.
Right.
Because the processors are shutting down.
Right.
Smithfield, which processes pork, a large percentage of the pork in the United States, they've already shut down like four meat processing facilities.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of listeners are going to say, oh, well, they're Chinese and they're shutting down for this or that reason. Well, JBS is also shutting down.
Right.
Brazilian, it turns out that there are about four meat packers, particularly in the beef industry. There are about four meat packers that own 90% of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And they're multinational companies.
Right.
And they're shutting down for various different reasons. Some of them have workers who tested positive, and that's what they're saying. The reason is, and I don't disbelieve that, but I also believe that one of the reasons they're shutting down is they're worried about the liability. If another worker contracts COVID,
right,
they come back and the family sues
right
the company. Anyways,
this
is what's happening. And I've had a piece of legislation for 5 years in Congress. I reintroduced it last year. I've got about two dozen co-sponsors, Democrat and Republican. Everybody recognizes the need for this. Farmers know we need this. Consumers know we need this. What my bill would do is it would unleash the small custom slaughterhouses, the custom meat packers, where you might have only six employees working in a facility. And instead of butchering 2,000 cows a day, they might butcher four cows a day.
Right.
And those places right now are shackled by regulations that are designed for the big meat packers.
Right.
And what I'm saying is take the shackles off. It wouldn't be Wild West. They're still inspected by the local health department. They're still inspected by state departments, and they're still subject to surprise inspections by the USDA. So it's not like these aren't inspected facilities.
Right.
Their crime is, according to the government, they haven't employed a full-time union USDA inspector.
Right. So I'm looking at a story right now backing you up. The number of South Dakota residents, according to hotair.com, who've tested positive for coronavirus, this is actually from CBS, has surpassed 1,100. More than half of those cases have ties to Smithfield Foods pork processing plant in Sioux Falls. That's one processing plant. It's a major one. To your point, it sounds as though the big businesses have kept guys like you from bringing about farm freedom because they want to protect their interest. But now that the country needs them more than ever, they can't fulfill their commitment because of the way that they were geared and regulated towards what their main business line was. But these smaller guys can't help because their hands have been tied by the lobbyists for the big guys. You know what I mean? I mean, that's what I feel like is happening here.
That's exactly what's happened. The big guys, the multinational companies, they've co-opted a lot of these farm organizations.
Right.
I'm not going to name them by name. Well, I'll name one, National Cattlemen's Association. Okay. They represent meat packers, not cattlemen.
Right.
But cattlemen trust them to represent their interests in Washington, D.C. But when it comes to like country of origin labeling, which I am a proponent of, the cattlemen opposed it when it was repealed for beef and pork.
Right.
I'm sorry, not the cattlemen. The cattlemen were for it. The National Cattlemen's Association was behind the scenes undermining the local cattlemen.
Right.
And there are other farm organizations that have done the same thing. Not going to call them all out. But what do they want? They want more regulations that shut down more small companies. And they've gotten this. They've created a very brittle food supply.
Right.
Where all the beef, you know, beef that's raised in Kentucky, you know, this is a typical path for a steer to get to a grocery store here in Kentucky. It's born on a farm in Kentucky. It's raised to about 500-600 pounds. It goes to Nebraska. It goes to a sale ring in Kentucky. Then it gets one of three buyers. Usually there's two or three buyers at the auction buying for 10 different folks. They take them to Nebraska. They feed them out. They butcher them at one of these four multinational companies owns the works. Then they ship it back to Kentucky, and it shows up in your restaurant or in your supermarket. Mm-hmm. Now, they love the big guys love this situation,
right?
Because not only are the consumers captive, because it has to have that USDA stamp on it, the farmers don't get to price their own cattle. They bring them to the auction house,
just hoping,
and it's rigged,
right?
I'm telling you. And they when you drop your cattle off, you wonder what you'll get. You get a check that's usually not what you were hoping it was, and you go home.
Right. No wonder small farmers would like it to go a different way, because if they had 50 head of cattle and they were going to take it to the auction, and instead they could go down to a local place that is inspected by the local health department, inspected by the state, and subject, as you said, to surprise USDA inspections, and they could butcher those cattle. And then those guys could take that cattle to the farmer's market, or they could take it to the grocery stores themselves, or they could sell it in some other way. They would be much better off. And in times like this, we'd be much more nimble to be able to deal with that.
Absolutely. And it's, by the way, it's a lot greener, this
right.
process you've just described, because you're not hauling a 600-pound animal one direction and then a 1,200-pound, butchered animal the other direction,
right,
across the country. And for what you spent on the fuel to get it out there and bring it back, the consumer can get a better, more local, more traceable product for the same price.
Right.
But the farmer makes more money.
Right. I would much rather have a steak that is from a cow that's been grown right there on that, Kentucky limestone watered grass, instead of maybe a piece of one that came by way of one of these auction houses from, North Dakota, which might be fine, but I'd rather have that Kentucky beef.
And by the way, I eat a hamburger now and then at McDonald's, but I know what I'm eating. I'm probably right. eating 20 or 30 different animals right. that have been commingled.
Right.
Right. And they weren't taken in their prime, right. But I'm not, that's safe. It's not gourmet. It's not the healthiest burger you'll ever eat.
Right.
But I'm not saying that we should shut down the big plants or that you shouldn't eat, food that comes from Nebraska. I'm saying that consumers should have an option, and that option has been taken away because of collusion between big business and big government.
And now
I'm using this opportunity to try and promote my bill
right.
called the Prime Act. And what the Prime Act would do is, as long as the meat is sold within a state, as long as it doesn't go into interstate commerce,
right.
why does the USDA need to be involved?
Right. Yeah, this makes total sense. We have, if you talk to Ryan Quarles, I think we're the fifth largest beef cattle producer in the country. Maybe it's the eighth. Either the fifth or the eighth. We're in the top 10. And we're the top beef cattle producer east of the Mississippi. There is plenty of beef in the state of Kentucky to feed the state of Kentucky. If we had to, in order to avoid a meat shortage, Kentuckians could continue to eat and have access to the food they need if this ridiculous regulation wasn't in the way.
Absolutely. And so that's why I'm promoting it. And I'm trying to get out in front of this because, like I said, right now you don't have shortages. There's a large supply in the frozen warehouses, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But my concern is we don't have government officials who are telling us when this country will be back open for business.
Right.
They're telling us, well, 2 more weeks. And then they say, well, 4 more weeks. Well, could be August. Right. Could be September. Right. Well, we might need to shut it down again later. And so I'm trying to plan ahead so we avoid this scenario where people go to the supermarket, they can't buy meat, yet the farmers are destroying animals on the farm. And it would all be because of these regulations we have in the middle. And I've had discussions with folks at the USDA, and they have one gear, and it is, they just keep talking about food safety. Well, how safe is it to starve?
Right. Right. I can't even begin to describe how ironic the picture would be if we have people in the state of Kentucky who have no access to ground beef because it's all gone at the grocery store, and yet we are the eighth largest producer of beef cattle in the country, and our farmers are having to euthanize those, not now, but down the road could potentially be having to euthanize those animals instead of feeding Kentuckians with them. That is a picture we don't even want to come close to.
That's right. And let me just say, right now in the state of Kentucky, the grass is coming on. And so the cattle price, they're lower than they were maybe 5 years ago before they repealed country of origin labeling. But they haven't fallen apart yet, because people still have grass growing. The grass is coming on. We have capacity to keep these animals in Kentucky this summer. Mm-hmm. But come this fall, if a certain number of those animals haven't gone to slaughter, there's not going to be enough hay to keep those animals around.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting.
And the reason they wouldn't go to slaughter is there's just not the capacity or the demand for it. Not to say there's not demand in the supermarket. There will be tremendous demand.
Well, isn't part of it, like you kind of went over this at the beginning, that the distribution pipeline, it's not that we're out of food. It's that the distribution pipeline is set up for one type of demand. Because of the shutdown, we literally overnight swung that demand to another pendulum. That distribution pipeline is not set up for that demand and has not yet and can't really gear up for that, because tomorrow they could turn the lights back on. So you can't ask those companies to redo their entire logistics process for what might be 2 weeks and might be 2 months. This to me is what has us staring down the barrel of a potential food shortage.
That's right. Like, take the dairy industry, for instance. I told you that cheese might go to a restaurant in a tote instead of an 8 ounce, individually labeled bag, or the milk might go in those little mini moo containers that say not for resale.
Right.
But in the supermarket, most of the dairy is sold in blow molded jugs. Well, nobody's going to buy more blow molding equipment to make those jugs.
Right.
Knowing that tomorrow it could all switch back in the other direction.
You're talking about asking them to make millions of dollars of investments for a temporary unknown period of time and then lose all of that money. They're not going to do it.
Right. And just to tell you how all interrelated this is, as the demand, I shouldn't call it demand because there's lots of demand for dairy. It's just in a different pipeline. As the capacity to take dairy from the farm to the market goes down, as milk gets poured out, dairy farmers can't afford to feed these cattle. So what they do is they sell them into the beef market. And in fact, there have been sort of government programs that promote selling that into the beef market so that they could, artificially reduce the supply of milk so that you can keep the price constant.
Right.
So what happens when the dairy farmers sell their cows into the beef market, the bottom falls out of the beef market.
Right.
And that is a double whammy on beef farmers.
Right. This to me feels like the best argument against overregulation that we've ever seen. I don't have any hope that we're, as Americans, going to recognize that, because again, Americans are too busy burying their heads in the sand and listening to the extremist media right now. But there's such great arguments here for not regulating beyond a certain amount. I mean, you have to regulate to protect, make sure that the meat and the milk is clean and that it's safe for consumption. But beyond that, we don't really need any regulations. The rest of the regulations really only protect the big over the small, and they bind us up in times of emergency like this.
And the regulations you have in place today are necessary because you're butchering 2,000 cattle at the same facility, and these cattle have come from all over the country.
Right.
And when there's a meat outbreak, it's not at one dinner table. When there's an E. coli outbreak, it's at 20 restaurants and 1,000 consumers before you get a handle on it.
Right.
Whereas if the beef was sold locally, and there is a lot of beef that's sold locally, but you have to buy like a half or a quarter of an animal. That's how this is all geared up.
Right.
Then if there is a problem, it's very minimized to like one or two customers, and it's traceable. They know the slaughterhouse that processed the beef, and they know the farmer that grew it.
Right, right. That makes more sense to bring it down to the local level where you can actually track it a little bit better. Another thing that concerns me is you were mentioning we don't know how long this is going to be. Have you been following Alex Berenson, the former New York Times reporter, who is one of the main high-profile voices questioning the paradigm of all of this lockdown? And he's warning now that we're starting to see the quote-unquote experts make a big pivot from the initial thing was they told us we have to shut the country down to dampen the curve, to lower the curve, to keep our hospitals from getting overrun. Now they're pivoting to a quote-unquote second wave. It feels like we have a bunch of Dustin Hoffmans from Outbreak, and they're running the frickin' country. It's like Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak, people don't realize that part of the plot of that movie was he was wrong every single time until the last time. And we've put somebody like that who has zero understanding of the economy, and they're just locking towns down left and right, and they're making a big pivot that you know, this could be going on for 2 years. There's no way that our economy could survive that.
No, it won't survive it. And the most humanitarian thing to do, the most compassionate thing to do, is to find that balance
right
between some of the mitigation policies and having our economy still firing on at least 7 of 8 cylinders.
Right.
Right now, it's we're throwing sand in the gearbox. And there's this whole discussion also about who can shut down the government, who can open it back up.
Right.
Well, the reality is the government was shut down, or the economy, I'm sorry, who can shut the economy down. The economy was shut down by state governments. And this was one of my arguments against the $2 trillion package, which was really a $6 trillion package, is that you're rewarding the governors who've shut down their economies, and you're telling the other governors if they haven't shut down their economies, they're going to have to once this bill passes.
Right.
So even if the president goes out and says, open your economies back up, if he's simultaneously encouraging Congress to give everybody $600 more a week for unemployment,
right?
If he's simultaneously, you know, sending grants, I'm not even going to call them loans because they don't expect them to be paid back, to sending grants to small businesses, if they're doing these sort of things, then it's like having your foot on the gas and on the brake at the same time.
Right.
And the car isn't going to go forward. You're just going to create a lot of wasted effort. And that's what I see is going to happen here pretty soon.
Well, you're going to burn the brakes up. You're going to burn the brakes out. Yeah. And then you won't have something to, you won't have something to help you in the next crisis because your brakes won't work.
That's right. And your tires will be, you know, worn out.
Yeah.
Because you're just sitting there spinning. And that's a problem. And that's – but so, you know, these sort of arguments about who has the authority are esoteric.
Right.
Follow the money.
Right.
And if people are worried about the liability of opening their businesses back up
– right.
Then they're not going to open them back up. And the liability is going to be generated because can you imagine the lawsuits that are going to be brought forth or maybe already brought forth? Ugh. The courts are closed right now. And they're going, what the expert witnesses are going to do is they're going to quote the presidential advisors who've,
right,
you know, made these prognostications and say, well, you should have known better. Here's what was being said at the time. And you negligently told people to come to work.
Right.
So it doesn't even matter if the president or the governor says open it up or shut it back down. If you're paying people to stay shut down, if you've got legal incentives to stay shut down, then it's going to stay shut down.
Well, but let me give the counter argument to that, because I agree with everything you say about if it's ongoing. I think the government, like, I don't have any problem. Well, I have a problem with the debt that we incurred, and I have no illusions that we're not all going to pay this money back. I had somebody ask me the other day, what do I do with my stimulus check? And I said, well, spend it, because they're going to get it back from you eventually. I mean, there's no way taxes aren't going up nationwide, because municipalities across the country that run on sales taxes have dried, their entire revenue system has dried up. So, but it's not a bailout. It's not the same as a bailout. These companies didn't make bad decisions. people didn't make bad decisions. The government shut them down and then sent them a check. Now, that check or that loan or whatever is not something that's going to last much longer than a couple of months. So as long as they don't do another wave of it, as they're also trying to open it up, I guess that's what I'm saying. I agree with you if it's ongoing. I don't think the first round is going to do that, what you say, but I think a second round or a third round would absolutely, because you would continue to encourage people not to work or not to go to work. And like you said, that bump in the unemployment was so high that there's a wide number of people that don't want to go back to work because they're getting more money. It's probably why polls are showing so many people want to stay in lockdown.
But Leland, I'm not sure. I don't remember the final language that was in the bill. I voted against the bill. But
right.
I don't remember if it said that this goes until December 31st. Of 2020, or if it was open-ended and said until the crisis or the emergency is over.
Right.
But and you know how these programs go. Once
they're in
place, if you don't renew it, people say, why are you taking it away?
Right.
They go with the presumptive close. They presume that it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
The $1,200 checks. And here's the other thing. They've already run out of money for the small business loan program.
That was today. I think they ran out of money. Yeah.
They didn't just run out of money because people want a loan. They ran out of money because this is free money.
Right.
Like when there is no end to the demand for free money.
Right.
And that's what was being offered. The banks aren't loan originators. They're grant administrators.
Right.
That's what we've turned them into.
Right.
And here's another thing, Leland. I got this. They started sending these $1,200 checks, was it yesterday or day before yesterday? Within an hour.
We got ours yesterday.
Okay. Within an hour of the first paycheck, of the first $1,200 check hitting somebody's bank account, I get a text from a friend who I've known for about 40 years. And he said, Dad just got his check. Well, I knew his dad too. His dad died 2 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. He said, does dad have to spend it online?
We're paying dead people.
And I know people are saying, how does that happen? Well,
right.
I mean, they filed the taxes for the father, you know, who passed away in 2018. They filed the taxes in 2018.
Right.
And then, a lot of people have joint accounts.
Right.
And if there's a survivor on the joint account, you know, there may be checks coming in that were genuinely owed to the estate
right.
or to the individual.
Right.
And so they typically may leave the deceased on the joint account for a little while.
Right.
Well, the government sees an account. They see a name. They see somebody that paid taxes in 2018. And I've already retweeted four other cases of this happening in the first day. Like, this isn't like some crazy anomaly. There's thousands and thousands of these. And my friend who sent me the information, when he said dad just got his check, he said, by the way, I'm not worried about a misplaced $1,200 check here and there. I'm wondering how many $10 million or $20 million dollar checks you all are misplacing.
Right.
Because all of the normal safety valves that are in place to stop fraudulent or negligent payments, they've short circuited all that. They've wired the valves open.
So the irony is we've deregulated in some areas that we shouldn't have, and we're overregulated in areas that if we aren't careful, we could end up having major pain. That's the irony of this conversation.
What they've deregulated is the government largesse
and the
flow of taxpayer money.
Right.
And borrowing the money and printing the money. They've taken the throttle off of that.
Yeah. Question.
Whereas at the same time, they've not taken the throttle off of private industry.
Right. Question. Did Congress members get a stimulus check?
I haven't checked my bank account, but I know it phased out at $75,000 per.
Right. And so all congressmen in 150 if you're joint. So all congressmen by nature would make more than that, because I think you guys make 200 and something, right?
174.
Okay. Well, then you got the standard deduction, though, which is 24,000. So if a congressman only makes what his salary is, and he's married, filing jointly, and his wife or her husband doesn't have income, they mm-hmm. probably got it, right?
I'll have to go check.
Yeah.
Text
me and follow up. I want to know if any congressman got it.
By the way, I'm wondering whether congressmen should even get paid, because
right.
Everybody was hating on me 2 weeks ago for making them come to work.
Right.
They were. I think we did a podcast on that. We did. Didn't
and
you and I?
Yeah, we did. And we talked about President Trump called you a third-rate grandstander. And now, yesterday, President Trump was calling on Congress to get back to work. So 3 weeks ago, President Trump was tweeting that you were a third-rate grandstander
because I wanted Congress to come to work.
And now he's begging Congress to go to work.
Yeah.
You should text him. You should text him right now and be like, hey, just saying.
I'm gonna leave that right there.
Let me ask one more question, because I know we've gone on for here a while, and I know you need to get back to work. Because I think people misunderstand, you know, I've been banging the drum about reopening and having a plan to reopen. I'm not an idiot, and I know, and I think everybody knows, that the normal we had before this is never coming back, ever. And that the economic recovery road is probably going to be a decade long. But we have to start somewhere. And to start somewhere, we have to start having conversations. I was walking into Whole Foods 2 days ago, and there was a sign on the front door that had an arrow pointing to the left, and it said mandatory temperature check station this way. And it was for employees, not for customers. They've done a number of things inside the store that keep me from having direct contact with other customers as well as the cashiers. They're checking the temperature of their employees every day. Once we have that, you basically could say to businesses, look, do X, Y, and Z, and you can reopen. Because we have avoided the overrun of the hospitals. That was the whole point of all this in the first place. We have to have the tough conversation with ourselves, the recognition that when we do open back up, some people are going to die. And that's a horrible thing. But more people will die if we don't open back up. And we have to understand that you have to take that risk sometimes, and that we could have basic things to sort of moderate that risk and then move forward. What does a reopening plan look like to you?
To me, it says, you know, when the factories reopen, everybody that's, you know, used to wearing a hairnet or safety glasses or a hard hat, you know, an N95 is part of that uniform at work now.
Right.
It says to me that you put automatic door openers on, like the ones they have at supermarkets.
Right.
You know, when I was a kid.
Right.
Put those on at the factory so you don't have 1,000 factory workers touching the same doorknob. There's so many. It means, yeah, get it. Once you get tested for the antibodies, you can skip both of those things, right? You can skip the mask, right?
Right.
It means that we need to have a cheap test that's like $5.
Right.
That
businesses can test their employees weekly and test their temperature daily.
Right. The pharmacist I told you about told me, hey, if I could get a cheap enough test, I would test every employee every day.
Right.
I want to make sure it's safe for employees and customers.
Right.
And so that's the, you know, that's what we would do. And, you know, there's so many common steps that, like, we should have done those in the interim instead of just going full lockdown.
Right. My thinking is that we would have avoided all of this economic pain, or most of it, if we had just done that from the beginning. And we probably wouldn't be very much different in terms of deaths and cases. That it would probably be about the same, if not even better. I mean, frankly, if you ask me, until everybody gets a mask, you know, it's just as dangerous to walk into Lowe's. It's just as dangerous to walk into the grocery store. We have close to my house one, you know, sort of regular grocery store that I won't go in it because I don't want to get this virus, right? And they've they've shortened the hours, and it's just mobbed with people every day buying all the toilet paper when they restock. And it's like I don't want to go in there because they've shortened the hours, so they're you know, doing all this stuff, and that's great, but by shortening the hours, they're jamming more people in. And then Lowe's and Home Depot, it's the only place people can go if they want to leave the house. So there's people it's the new mall. There's people wandering around in there, don't have any reason to be in there. And so it's become this petri dish, right? So it's like, it would be better if just everybody just had a mask and you just let the retail stores open. Let me go get a freaking haircut, you know?
Yes. By the way, my wife gave me a haircut an hour ago.
Oh, I'm jealous. My wife is like, she's like, I could just buzz it all off. And I'm like, nah, I think I'll avoid that. So why is it so hard to break this shell, though? Because it seems like there is a vice grip right now on our politicians. They are caught between two pressures. One, these experts whose models have all been wrong. And two, the media who smells blood in the water, sees an election coming up. And it's the only way they can get a guy who I think, sadly, and I'm not making fun of him, is suffering from dementia into the White House. Honestly, I think that's the reason why we won't see governors open up anytime soon.
Yeah, you know, I'm not blaming the media on this one. There are enough of my colleagues who are culpable that I'm going to blame them. And also, you know, the people have some responsibility, too. I see a lot of Republicans cheering on Andy Beshear.
Yes.
And I don't understand why. There was a protest at the Capitol yesterday, and there were with social distancing protest, right? Andy Beshear, open our government back up.
Right.
And I saw some Republicans get mad at the folks who were at the Capitol protesting. And public perception is going to have to change. I think what's going to do it is when people start getting hungry.
Yeah.
When they start going to the store and the shelves are empty, not just for a day, but for a month.
Right.
And then they're going to say, you know, I'm not real crazy about having everything shut down.
I think you're right. I think there was a Kentucky state legislator, and I don't know which one it was, but he said your perception of this lockdown or this virus is directly attributable to whether you get a paycheck. And I think that there is a large portion of America that either is still getting a paycheck or had enough savings or, you know, they've been able to dip into their 401k or do whatever they have to do. And they're enjoying a Netflix vacation right now. And they don't see that just the other day there was 10,000 cars lined up at 6 a.m. in front of a makeshift food bank in San Antonio, Texas, because that side of the population is starving to death. And I think the people that are in their Netflix bubble that are posting their home workout videos on Instagram don't have any idea what that portion of society is going through. And they don't seem to realize that they are going to be those people in those lines if this continues much longer.
Well, just to paint a picture for you, and I hope it doesn't come to this, but this is how it spirals down real quickly and how everybody becomes part of the same group. When your child is hungry and you go to the store and there's nothing there to buy,
right?
You're going to rationalize taking it from your neighbor.
Yes.
In fact, the people who have prepared, that will be considered a sin.
Yes.
To have, I mean, they're already calling, you know, the hoarding
right.
sinful or, you know, unpatriotic. And so the people who don't have, and these will be law-abiding, God-fearing people, will rationalize stealing from their neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Once that starts happening, and by the way, I believe there's a lot of capacity in our society to help for neighbors to help neighbors out, but
right.
it's going to wear thin,
right.
if, you know, if the shortages go on for too long. Once people start taking from neighbors, then everybody has to stay home to watch their stuff.
Right.
And then the people who were going, the 50% attendance that you had at the factories
right.
is going to go to zero.
Right.
And nothing will get made. And that's like pouring just, you know, 10 pounds of sand in your car's transmission.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to lock everything up immediately. And no amount of cranking on the starter is going to start it again until right. you take it all back apart.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't come to that. But what
me too.
What you've
I'm not saying it will.
Right. What you've described, though, is different catalysts, same result of Stalinist Russia. Different catalysts. In Stalinist Russia, it was Stalin, you know, and he filtered into society that anybody who's collecting for themselves is a sinner and part of the people that need to be eliminated and put on trains and taken to prison camps and killed. And that was that went for farmers who gathered a few potatoes and stored them up for themselves instead of giving it to the common good. But we're seeing the same result. It's a different catalyst in this case. It could be the same result. I take hope in the fact that Politico just posted an article, though, that the shutdown backlash is coming soon and with a vengeance. That's the title. And I think government better understand that, you know, we're at a crossroads here. And when people start to wake up and they get angry and they say, I want to go back to work, there's going to be two paths for America. We can either let them or there'll be violence and unrest. And I think, you know, that protest at the Capitol was the angry but civilized version of what could be coming a month from now if Andy Beshear and others don't get their act together and start planning for how we come out of this.
Right. And the shortages, the one thing that I could see bringing some sensibility around is when you start having food shortages, maybe not where you can't get any kind of meat, but you go to the store and there's only two kinds of meat, right? You can either have an arm roast or you can have a ham hock. Right. And that's it. There's no hot dogs. There's no chicken wings. There's no steak. There's no hamburger.
Right.
And that's when the people who are enjoying staying home watching Netflix are going to start to say, you know, we got to wrap this thing up and get back to life.
Yeah.
As we know it.
100%. Congressman, I hate the circumstances that we're talking this time. I hope that, you know, we can find that light at the end of the tunnel. And I hope that America will do what's right in this case. I feel like maybe there's an enormous number of people that have just come to a place where they don't value freedom as much as they value safety anymore. I think that that was not the case 20 or 30 years ago, but I think it is now. And that's what terrifies me the most.
Well, I hope when we look back on this, the folks who write history don't say, well, this little taste of socialism is what saved us. Right. And so going forward, we need a big taste of socialism.
Right.
I would say, hopefully, when they look back on this, they'll see that what the activity that the government undertook was a lot like the New Deal.
Right.
And prolonged suffering.
Yeah.
And cause more deaths and poverty. But we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the meantime, we can be hopeful, right?
Yeah, we can. We can and we must. I think ultimately we must be. So, Congressman, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Leland.
All
right. Talk to you later.
All right. Have a good one. That's Congressman Thomas Massie. I don't want to leave it on a negative note for the week, but at the same time, I mean, this is the reality of the situation we're in. The story that I mentioned that was just posted by Politico, that the backlash is coming and it's going to come with a vengeance. And I think that you're about to see that, where you're going to see that those among our society that value liberty more than anything else are going to get tired of this, that we understand there's a risk. We understand that, America's in a tough spot right now. People are going to die from a virus, but far more people are going to die from the economic consequences if we don't get our government leaders' heads out of the sand. And you can stand up in mom jeans and turtlenecks and do sign language and read Facebook posts all day long if you want, Governor Andy Beshear. But at the end of the day, we got to have a plan to get out of this. So anyway, all right, much more to come. We're going to talk about that plan to get out of this next week. There are organizations, the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, Greater Louisville, Inc. They're both coming out with plans to try to help urge our governor in the right direction and talk about ways that we can reopen the economy with common sense social distancing still in place. I think a lot of people that are knee-jerk reacting and saying that those of us that are talking about business, I think a lot of them are making the assumption that we want people to die, and that's not true. We can fight both of these things at once. We can fight for the economy and fight the virus at the same time. And that includes people wearing masks and continuing to do so, people continuing to be at least 6 feet apart, people continuing to use hand sanitizer and wash their hands, and businesses putting in place plans to keep customers 6 feet apart and plans to test their employees. And once you do that, we have the hospital capacity and the respirator capacity, and we have the ability to take care of those that do get sick, then you get to work. And then herd immunity takes over, and then hopefully a virus comes out soon. Or excuse me, a vaccine comes out soon. And that's how we have to deal with this, and we have to be willing to take the risk to do exactly that. Otherwise, far more people will die. Trust me. All right. If you want to help share and spread the voice of this podcast, share it with your friends. Get everybody to download and to subscribe. Excuse me, scribe. It is only, subscribing is only for free. It's $0. It is only $0 and 0 cents. And you can subscribe at Apple Podcasts, at Google Play, Spreaker, and of course, iHeartRadio's app. And iHeartRadio will send you an email and deliver me to your pocket every time a new episode jumps out there. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, as well as our helping us with the music of this program, Dynamics Audio Productions in Lexington, dxaudio.com, for all your production needs. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And on Instagram, it is at Leland Conway, or excuse me, at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.